main worries is that we do not know when it's going to end. It's an endless story, and this is the worry. And will everything come back to normality? Because at the beginning they thought yes. Now we do not think that. We think that nothing will be ever the same.
Welcome to the IPA podcast. For those of you who have been listeners to the past 40 episodes of this podcast series, you know that we've been focusing on analysts who bring their clinical skills to venues outside of the consulting room, hence the name psychoanalysis on and off the couch. Given that we are all facing together a crisis of unfathomable proportions, we're going to be changing the focus of our podcast. We are going to be interviewing psychoanalysts from all corners of the globe to discuss with them how their local communities are coping with this situation, how their clinical work has been affected by this situation, and also how the internal worlds of both the analyst and the patient have been impacted by this virus, as it impacts both our real fears and our imaginary fears. We're going to encounter not only uncertainty and fear, but we're also going to learn great wisdom, gifted empathy, and hope. We'll be maintaining the title of this podcast, both as a testament to our past work and as a placeholder for our future work. I hope you find these conversations both informative and sustaining. Feel free to write comments on our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Simonetta Diana. Dr. Diana is a psychiatrist and a training and supervising psychoanalyst at the Italian Psychoanalytic Association. She is also a fellow of the research training program of the International Psychoanalytic Association. Dr. Diana's interests are wide. She has published and spoken on eating disorders, on art and film, on trauma. And her latest book in English in 2018 is called Psychoanalysis, Listening to Love. But for all these interests and abilities, our conversation today is, of course, focused on the pressing crisis we're all operating under. Dr. Diana lives and works in Milan, and we will learn a great deal about life in Milan and the psychoanalytic life in Milan. But if there's one sentence from this conversation that captures the essence of what we're facing, it was when she said, "I did something I've never done before." And we're all going to find ourselves doing things we've never done before. And what our conversation, for me, teaches is that one both has to face the challenge of dealing with this pressing, literal danger and reality we are all operating under, and also maintain a focus on metaphor and analytic reality. And as you'll hear, she certainly contains the ability to do both. And I hope you find it as meaningful as I do. Here's my conversation with Dr. Simonetta Diana. Simonetta, welcome to the podcast. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Before we begin discussing life in Italy and life in Milan, tell me and us, you and your family's health, it's okay?
Yes, everybody is fine. My husband and I, we're living together in the house, and my son and his wife are living together in another house in Milan, and my daughter, who is 8 months pregnant, is living with her husband in Rome, and but she's doing great. We're a little worried for the delivery, of course, but
I'm glad to hear, sure.
They didn't organize it.
We here in the States hear a great deal about life in Italy, in Milan and Lombardy in particular, and we're told that your area has been, after China, the most affected by the virus in the world. Now, just so our listening audience knows, you and I are speaking on Sunday, March 22nd. And I say that because so much changes so fast for so many people and countries. But can you fill us in on what you're aware of as happening in your community health-wise?
Well, everything, I suppose, started in December, when we heard from our friends who were general practitioners and that there was something strange, something weird in the flu that was going on. You know, every year there is a flu. Mm-hmm. This flu was, they had consequences like pneumonia, which were hard to pass. And I had few friends who had got pneumonia, and they never had it. And we, of course, we were vaccinated against the flu. So we didn't worry. It was just a note. Mm-hmm. Then we started listening from China, and February the 20, they shut schools, they shut the cinemas, they shut the museums, they shut La Scala, they shut the conservatory music halls, the theaters, and everything that could be, you know, a way to gather together a lot of people. They didn't shut, I don't know why, and we're thinking about now, you know, shut the football games, which was a terrible mistake because it was a way, one of the worst place to, for the virus to move. So what we think, what is generally thought now is that viruses has started moving in Italy, and especially in Lombardia, which is the most populated area in Italy, and also the most industrialized and where the work is, and it's a rich region. A lot of people come to Lombardia every day from other cities, from other regions, from other countries. And I have patients from different countries. I speak English with them. I do analysis in different languages. And so it's a sort of an international city, Milan. So it's very populated. And and mobility is very strong. It's very high. People move all the time and go. They go to Rome, they go to Turin, they go to Venice daily, you know, up and down, because it's 3 hours. So it started then, but we didn't know. As I told you, we had this disaster in a hospital because a patient whom... they never understood where he got it, arrived in the emergency room saying that he didn't feel well and he was already affected with the coronavirus, and then he infected the whole hospital, and this was Codogno, the famous Codogno. When I mean the whole hospital, I mean everybody, every doctor, every anesthesiologist, and the nurses, the people at the doorman. So they shut the small town. They shut 4, 5, 6 other town, small town around them. And they became a red zone, means that nobody could leave or enter. And now these zones are free from the virus. They didn't have a big toll of death because there is a discussion about the death now, because mostly people who die are mostly old people who are already sick for other reason, like they have cancer, and or they have dementia, or they have especially heart disease, in a very bad condition. Of course, The cause of death it's the virus, but they would have gotten any other virus anyway. So, but they are counted as death. And there it's terrible. For example, in the resting rooms, in the resting home, the death toll is enormous. Also in the among the nuns and in the convents.
That's what we've been hearing.
Yeah, it's in the prisons, all the closed population, people living together in a community who is sick. The hospitals are terrible, terrible way to...
I've been hearing about in Italy, as in the States, and probably many places around the world, that there's been a terrible shortage of protective masks and gowns and ventilators, with many people dying as a result of this. Is that been what you've been hearing, or you know firsthand?
Well, the real problem is that there wasn't enough distance between people, because the masks they give you are not sufficient for the virus, and they're useless. The mask you will get in the States, they're useless if you meet the virus, because the one they use in the hospital, they're the good one, but you will never get them. So it's not so useful. What I do, I use, you know, the mask that they gave you in the on the plane for your eyes.
Yes,
yeah,
sure.
I put them on my, that's what doctor said, that they're as useful as...
It's the placebo mask. It makes us feel better.
Exactly.
Yes, I understand.
Exactly.
Can you tell us a bit about how this has affected the psychoanalytic community before we get to your own situation?
Well, there was, at the beginning, there was a sort of discussion about whether to go remote or that we could see the patients or not, because people were saying, well, we are not operating with the body of the patients, we are not too close to them, and we are not sick, and they are not sick, they don't take public transportation. And people were, they didn't really understand what was going on.
Yes. They didn't understand that one could be contagious without being symptomatic.
They didn't. It was a denial, and it was an omnipotence. But still, there was a difference between Lombardia and Rome, and South Italy, because there it was much less important what was happening, and they didn't understand, they didn't believe us. We started saying, please stay home, because you are contagious also if you are not sick, please stay home. Try to stop the virus, and they didn't. Then there were useless discussion about, you know, the setting, to how to protect the patients, what to do. And so this is, in my opinion, it's a completely useless discussion, because this is the way it is. It's a war. We are in war, and we have to adapt. We cannot say, I do not accept it. You have to. And you have to adapt to the new condition. Of course, the setting is completely different, because the absence, the physical absence of the body of the patient and of the analyst makes everything a little unreal, and they know it. But then you, the patient and you, we are both living the same situation. And we, in my experience, all the patients were relieved that we were seeing each other through Skype because it was less dangerous. And it was a little bit difficult for people who were on the couch because they were watching the face of the analyst for the first time, let's say, during. But then they weren't really watching. We aren't really watching each other. We are listening. I know there are callers who just they switch off the video.
Yes.
During the analysis, I don't. It's already too much the distance. I prefer to have it. Then, so the first the absence of the body, then the absence of what I call the surrounding. That is, you do not open the door. They do not walk into your waiting room. They just enter. And you enter into their home, and they enter. Well, they enter into your office, which is the same. But
sometimes some people are working from their home, and they're exposed to some.
But I work from my office. But the problem is that there is, no doubt about it, an intrusion. About, as I was telling you yesterday, I can see what you like, what you are, beside what you're telling me.
Sure.
So this is, but then again, it's something that, you know, the first session, the second session, then it's, you get used to it. I didn't have people who said no thanks, the so-called no thanks. Everybody was relieved, except one patient who is old and who said that she didn't really feel, she preferred the telephone, to speak at the telephone instead of using the computer. But still she was... she remained with me. I was thinking yesterday about your question about the clinical. What is different in the clinical? So for the setting, I told you one is the lack of the body, both of the patients and the analysts. Second is the lack of the environment of the office.
Let me just ask you for clarification on this. You referred to people having difficulty, analysts having difficulty recognizing the collapse of metaphor to some degree. That is, that the usual frame that's designed to elicit and embellish metaphoric meanings was being threatened. And everybody is focused on the literal in the move to new circumstances that are required by real dangers, not by internal fantasy. That's one change.
Well, I was already used to Skype analysis.
I see.
I know it takes a little while to listen to what the patient are saying. With a different, with a third ear.
Yeah, different, yeah.
You're listening differently, in the same way that when they're on the couch. So you build the metaphors in the same way. It doesn't change. The only thing that is really different is that it's more difficult. It's tiring for you.
Yes.
Because you cannot use the fluctuant attention, but you have to be very attentive and able to build something which has to do the meaning of the inner speech, and more than the meaning of the reality. But you have to do it every time. In fact, when you asked me about the clinical examples, I realized the problem of the worries, that all my patients started talking about how worried they were, each one for a different reason. One was worried for a woman at his job who was harassing her. Another was worrying for the organization of the job. Another was worried, you know, they were.
Yes.
And after a day, a whole day, I had, you know, this insight, and I thought, gosh, am I stupid? Of course they're worried, but they're worried of what is going on.
Yes.
So I the session, the day after, I listened to their worries, and I said, yes, I understand you're worried, but I think that you're worried also for something else that you do not want to think about it. And of course they were relieved, and they said, well, main worries is that we do not know when it's going to end. It's an endless story, and this is the worry, will everything come back to normality? Because at the beginning they thought yes, now we think that nothing will be ever the same, but it's okay, it's not, we are in touch, we work together. And people who are alone said, oh, I always be alone, but now that there is WhatsApp, Skype, and so on, I feel that I'm more in touch with everybody else, because everybody's calling, keeps calling and calling, to know if we are alive and what happened to us, and so on.
The other difference of this circumstance is that the worry is shared by analyst and analyst and. Perhaps not identically, but perhaps identically. That changes the listening, no?
Yeah, I thought about it. I don't know why that I'm not worried myself. I'm not worried. First, because I think that I already had the virus as my husband. So I am probably contagious. No, I don't.
Not contagious.
Asymptomatic. Then because I'm in good health, it's so I'm not worried about my life, and thanks God we do not have old parents to look after. But I can feel the worries of my son, of my daughters. They are worried, and they are worried about that.
Sure.
We can be, but I am not worried, and this is very important for the patients, that I'm not worried about what will happen. I have patients who had finished their analysis, and they called because they were sick, and they wanted to start again and speak, they weren't very sick, but they definitely had the virus. And they wanted to be reassured, but then they wanted to, more than this, they wanted what was the analysis, something to share and to build together, not something that they were alone to deal with. So
Did they want to check to see that you were okay?
Yes, some of the old patients could, yes.
Yeah.
Especially the very old patients. Most of them called to say, "Oh, doctor, I just wanted to say hello. They didn't ask me, how are you?"
Right. I understand, but you picked up the phone, right?
By the way, yes. How are you?
Yes. Yes.
I'm still alive, thanks. But this was nice, very nice. And what I did, which I never did before in my life, I sent messages to old patients to know how well they're doing. I was worried a little bit.
Of course. I think that sentence, I did something I've never done in my life before, is something that all of us either have said or will say in the upcoming weeks and maybe months. We will be doing things that we've never done before.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what, for example, people drinking during the session or smoking. This is, of course, a non-smoking area, but if they do smoke at home, they smoke during the session. Huh. And they ask, "Do you mind if I smoke?" And at the beginning, I said, "Well, of course I don't."
It's not your house, right?
But I can say, "Do you mind if I interpret this, the fact that you're smoking?"
Can you give us some clinical examples that will allow people to get a glimpse of what the experience has become for you and your patients?
Well, a patient of mine who is he's the headmaster of a school started bringing problems of organization, what to do and how to organize a life. And he was very worried. You know, it's not easy to organize online lectures for all the classes and the teachers. But he's very good and he could do it. But then I said, I interpreted that what he was saying, that he was worried that he couldn't organize and in this new setting the different structure of his ego, superego, and drives, he was worried that I couldn't make a difference and understand very well the conflicts between the drives and the superego or the ego and, you know, the usual one, what we call the ego structure, and that the organization he was talking to put together and was something he was worried that I couldn't be able to put together his whole personality, because we were not together in the same room. And I said, of course you are worried about it, but this is, I think, something we can deal together because we know each other. And you'll help me to understand when I do not understand something.
So just so I understand that, so is it that you felt you were reassuring him that by your observing the transference displacement, you were in fact reassuring him that you could continue to function analytically?
Exactly, but not reassuring. I do not reassure, and it's not my way of working. I was just telling him that he was worried that I couldn't do it.
And that you were therefore functioning in that comment.
Yes, and I said, I can see that you are in conflict now. And you are afraid. And then I also ask you what does come to your mind about this? Why are you afraid that I cannot understand in this new situation? So he reminded that the job of his mother was very tiring, and his mother couldn't understand most of the time what he was feeling. And so it was very useful, of course. Then a patient who was left by her boyfriend and who was suffering very much, she said that she was now living alone more than she was doing before, but it was a living alone differently because she couldn't understand why. And so I said that maybe she was also, and again, I made a metaphor. I said, well, it seems to me that what you're saying is that you feel that you are not alone in this terrible abandonment that you had. And because I've always been with you, and I share this fear, this anguish, these anxieties you had, and now you feel it's more clear to you that you're not alone in this situation. Is it? Am I clear enough?
Yes, I think you're making your point. Yes, that first and foremost, that she was referring to the both literal and metaphoric connection with you in her comment of aloneness.
And again, I didn't need to ask her what does come to your mind, because she said, of course, it has to do with my parent, with my mother, because she's caring and loving, but she doesn't understand. And in this situation, she wasn't definitely with me, and I felt alone because not only I was abandoned by my boyfriend, but my family as well. And I can see now that analysis was very helpful, because I was not abandoned by you. I was with you. So, and it's different. And I am learning how to be alone and not to be alone. That's what she said, I remember. And she said something very interesting. She said, because I am a mind which cannot function alone. That's what she said. And I understood it now. Yeah, I loved it.
Huh. Simonetta, you seem so present in the work you're describing. Can you tell us what's sustaining you in this process?
Well, we ask, I think, first of all, I feel that I'm not alone. I am in a community, an international community, which is very important, and a national community. I have a lot of friends, and we are connecting. We don't see each other, but we see through Skype, WhatsApp, Hangouts, all different kind of. And then I had this memory about my mother after the war. Well, not that I met her, but my mother used to say we wanted to have fun after the war so much, and we had so much fun after the war. And she wasn't talking about the war. She never said anything. So I have the feeling that what we're living now, it's something. Of course, we'll overcome. And after that, life will be wonderful, because we have so much drive and wish to live and be happy, move physically. We do not move physically. This is very,
yes.
It's very painful for a lot of people, young people as well. And then we need to be strong, because, for example, our daughter, who is a doctor as well and works in the hospital with very sick patients, children, and she's scared about the delivery, because she's scared that she can get the virus while she's there. In fact, so we need to reassure her and be strong for them, and we had this feeling that dear, our children are, they are 32 and 34. They are worried for us. And we need to show them that they don't need to be worried because we are dealing very well. And we are building, preparing the room for the new baby and organizing vacation, holidays, and the Passover. We organized the Passover through Skype, usually. And this is something that at the beginning made me cry, really cry. One night I woke up and I started crying for this because usually there are 30 people over at home for Passover. And now there will be only my husband and I. But then, little by little, all the cousins and nephews and children, of course, they said, well, we need to organize a platform to do the Seder together. Yes. So it was, I felt that we were the family, you know.
Yes. You say your mother never spoke about her war experiences, but she did share with you her optimism and her delight at the end of the war, which still lives in you so bountifully.
Yes. My father as well.
Yes. That's— you've taught us much. You've taught us not just about Milan, but about your encounter with your patients and your inner analytic life. You've shared with us about how you can take quite seriously and quite literally the actual literal dangers we face, and also do the best you can with your patients to also maintain a capacity to recognize metaphor. And that is our challenge. And you say, as many have said, it is tiring.
It is tiring, but I can tell you, it is tiring because you have to do every single session, which is what you do normally without realizing it. But with Skype, you have to do it on purpose.
Yes, with more intention.
Yes.
More energy.
This makes it different.
Yes. Simonette, I want to thank you for spending time with us, for sharing your personal situation. Needless to say, I wish you and the community well. And hopefully you'll be able to keep us informed about how everybody's doing. And I wish you and your daughter's upcoming birth all good things.
Thank you. Thank you, Harvey. Let me know how it will go.
Be well. Bye. Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.